We are going to energize the country.
We need to wake up and smell the coffee.
No more Mr. Nice Guy.
Another future's possible, but we've got to fight for it.
Order!
Hello and welcome to the Debated Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Will. And in this episode, I'm delighted to be joined by Wendy Chamberlain, the Lib Dem MP for North East Fife, Chief Whip of the Liberal Democrats, the Lib Dem spokesperson for Scotland and Wales, and the Lib Dem spokesperson for pensions and welfare. She's also contributed to and partly edited an excellent new book that's recently come out entitled The Future of Social Democracy, Essays to Mark the 40th Anniversary of the Limehouse Declaration, for which there will be a launch event on Monday, the 25th of January. Welcome to the podcast, Wendy.
Hi, thanks, Will.
So the first question that I'd like to ask is, what prompted the writing of this book? What made you decide to contribute to it?
Well, I think it's obviously the anniversary on Monday itself, the 40th anniversary of the Limehouse Declaration, which was obviously the start of the SDP that joined with the Liberals alliance, became the Liberal Democrats. And I think important to recognise the contribution of the SDP to the party. And also, I think if we look at, well, look at the events of this week, we've obviously seen the inauguration of Joe Biden in the States, replacing, you know, I have lots of words to describe Donald Trump, but a populist, and in some ways, has social democratic principles been on the wane? And so I think the book is useful from the perspective of looking at some really big ticket items and asking where social democratic principles have a place within that. Because actually, if you look, and contributors talk about this, there is the reality of some real social radical democratic principles, ideas, policies have really, really changed the way we live our lives, not just in the UK, but Europe and elsewhere.
Now, why do you think that the SDP had such an impact on the history of politics? Because if you look at more recent splinter groups, like, for example, Change UK, they perhaps didn't have the same impact in terms of changing the course of political history. Why do you think that was?
I think there's a couple of reasons. I think the 70s, I was born during the 70s, so don't remember them, but they were clearly a tumultuous time from a political perspective. And you saw minority governments. It's easy to forget that, you know, those were quite common. And dare to say, we were having elections on almost a more regular basis than we have over the last 5 years. And then I definitely think that the standing of the politicians who broke away to form the SDP, Roy Jenkins, Shirley Williams, Bill Rogers and David Owen, is the other thing that was very, very clear. And that's not to do any disrespect to those politicians who were involved in Change UK. But I think obviously having held such high elected office in the case of some of them, there was obviously that key point where, well, if they feel this strongly, that they are willing to sacrifice, you know, future political career, which was clearly the impact for Change UK as well, that people should take up and take notice. And I suppose as well, I think, you know, given the percentages that they reached in the polls, though ironically that didn't then put itself into seats, they really did capture a moment in the early 80s.
Do you think, because, I mean, you mentioned the polling that the SDP Liberal Alliance had in the 1980s. Do you think that had people been perhaps more willing to back a more unconventional party arrangement as the SDP Liberal Alliance was, do you think that they could have overtaken the Labour Party in 1983 as the chief opposition? Had things been a bit more different and people been a bit more willing to support a different kind of party arrangement?
Of course, anything's possible when you look at the percentage support that they had, but it's always the challenge for a third party in UK politics in terms of how do you make that breakthrough. Our electoral system, indeed our parliament, as I've discovered since my election 2019, is physically and culturally set up for the support of two parties, a two-party system. So it was in neither Labour or Conservative interest to kind of let them in, as it were.
Now, in the introduction of the book, Vince Cable talks about the social democratic tradition in the Labour Party, and he says that it only temporarily dominated the Labour Party under Neil Kinnock, John Smith and Tony Blair. Do you agree with that assessment? And if so, why do you think that that was the case?
I think overall, generally, yes, I do. And I think actually the recent history of the Labour Party sort of brings that to light as well. One of the things I think is interesting about the book, though, is the social democratic tradition that we're talking about is not limited to existing within the Liberal Democrats today. You know, we have contributors from other parties and none. And obviously you will see that there are a couple of contributors. A good example is Ian Cairns, who's now leading the Social Liberal Foundation, who came to the Liberal Democrats from Labour. So actually there's that same kind of bleed or movement is taking place. So I think for that reason, I think Vince is onto something there.
Do you think that part of the reason that there is this lack of dominance of social democracy in the Labour Party is partly to do with that it seems almost like a compromise for some people in the Labour Party, that it seems like a watering down of ideology, and they feel that if they accept certain social democratic principles that this may, you know, unpurify the socialism which they want to bring to government?
I can see the logic in that argument. I think rather than talking necessarily about Labour Party, I think there is that bit in social democracy around a piece of pragmatism. And I think from a Liberal Democrat perspective, we are a broad church. So actually, you know, and actually I saw somebody responding, a member responding in relation to the book, how pleased he was to see recognition of our liberal, our social democrat tradition, that actually there are key things probably that liberals and social democrats disagree on, but we take a pragmatic approach. And actually when it comes to the radical solutions, in the main, we're aligned. And you know, as a party, we always like to discuss policy. I think sometimes that can it means that we're very passionate, we're very well thought through, and actually we've generally got a good degree of consensus. It's always the irony that our manifestos are sort of best critiqued by the experts, but clearly don't cut through to the wider electorate.
At the end of his introduction, Sir Vince Cable discusses the need for stronger links with the European Union now that we have left. Do you think that this is something that people will perhaps be more palatable and be more willing to accept, given some of the disruptions we've already seen with Brexit?
As of the situation we're currently in is we will, I think for me, there's been almost a thinking that once you've determined to leave the EU and you've left the EU, that's the end of it. You don't need to have further discussion. You don't need to further engage. Thing that really impacts on that is geography, and the reality is we will always have a relationship with the European Union, form it takes, from a trade or cultural perspective, because they are our nearest neighbours. And yes, you're right, we are obviously seeing a degree of disruption. Obviously it's not potentially in the public consciousness in the way it would be in normal times, and clearly we are not in normal times during the pandemic. But I think, you know, Brexit has been described as a slow puncture, and arguably it's been a slow puncture since 2016, as obviously businesses have made decisions and results, and we're seeing that continuing now. But I wouldn't want to suggest that our relationship with the EU is something that's purely economic. It's wider than that, and obviously as a Scot I recognise that too.
Do you think that this is something that, particularly in Scotland, is going to be an issue in the upcoming, if they do happen, Scottish parliamentary elections, making that case from parties that are not the SNP, that, you know, even though that we have had Brexit, we do need to find some way to continue to work with the European Union and convince the voters that, well, you know, you don't need to leave the United Kingdom to necessarily continue to have links with the EU?
Yeah, I think the EU is clearly, and constitutional debates clearly, and I refer to those in my chapter of the book, are going to continue to be a subject of debate. And in many ways, that's right and healthy that democracy grows and changes and develops with countries. On the other hand, where it completely overarches all, which is certainly what we've seen over the last decade, at least until the pandemic hit, isn't necessarily healthy. But yes, it's clearly we're in a position where, from a pro-UK party perspective in Scotland, all pro-UK parties are being accused of being pro-Brexit. Now, obviously, that for me as a Liberal Democrat, I am pro-European. I think the best place for UK and Scotland is to be in the EU. But we had a referendum, we had a general election in 2019, and while the Conservatives have an 80-seat majority, rejoin is a distant prospect. But that doesn't mean that I won't continue to argue for the closest possible relationship and to look to rejoin, because I do think that's the right thing. But yes, it's clearly going to continue to be an object of debate.
Now, I'd like to turn to your essay, because your essay, which is the first full essay of the book, is about proportional representation. And you make the argument that proportional representation is needed now more than ever because of the, as you mentioned, Conservatives having an 80-seat majority yet only gaining 44% of the vote. Do you think that this is something that people in the public are perhaps going to be more palatable seeing the scale of the Conservative Party's majority? Or do you think that it's still something that might be difficult to argue to the public as an important issue?
Yeah, I think there's two parts of it for me, and it's actually less to do about the current Conservatives majority, and it's more to do with just in terms of the referendums that we've had. And the reality is, for me, is referendums in relation to the parliamentary democracy that we currently have in the UK are a bad idea, because we elect people to parliament to represent our views, and then we have a referendum on top of that that dictates what those parliamentarians should do. Yeah. And so I think clearly the closeness of the referendum in 2016 has kind of driven that degree of division. And ironically, and I do mention this in the chapter, is that in England, where potentially that prospect of the left behind or aspects around the Brexit vote are actually the part of the UK that are least well represented from a proportional system, because so much of the local democracy and national democracy is first past the post. The second issue, I think, is Labour, going back to Labour again, because, you know, realistically, and Clive Lewis, I've heard him speak at a couple of events now, where is the pathway to victory or a majority Labour government, either in 2024 or arguably beyond into 2028, particularly if the situation in Scotland doesn't change for Scottish Labour? And, you know, obviously we're approaching Scottish Parliament elections in May, and, you know, they're currently leaderless, so that doesn't suggest that they're going to be making significant inroads now. So I think there is an increasing realisation in Labour that something needs to change. And I also think that the cross-party groups such as Makes Votes Matter and Electoral Reform Society have kind of recognised that, and it does feel less tribal as an argument. So Make Votes Matter, for example, are actually taking an approach via CLPs, where they get CLPs to sign up in support of proportional representation. And that's, you know, that very much ground roots. And obviously Labour have moved to STV for some of their NEC elections. So it suggests that they know that actually the system in its current form doesn't work.
Do you think that there's also part of a difficulty in convincing the public about the need for electoral reform is that, particularly with parties like the Liberal Democrats, which obviously, you know, in comparison to some of the other parties, don't have as many MPs, that there might be, you know, a reaction from some members of the public, oh, well, you know, it's people who don't have as many MPs, they want to gain more MPs through some change to the system. How best do you think you can combat that kind of prejudice to an argument for electoral reform?
I think the cross-party aspect is key. You know, in terms of, and I'm mentioning Make Vote Matters again, in terms of their good systems, the Brexit Party, or the Reform Party as they're now called, are actually one of those signatories, because in 2019, the biggest impact the Brexit Party had on the general election was depriving people who wanted to vote for them of the opportunity to do so in Conservative held seats. So that just, for me, just doesn't seem right, no matter how vehemently I might disagree with the Brexit Party, Reform Party, and what they stand for. And arguably, potentially, if UKIP had better representation, the Brexit Party in Westminster, we might actually have had those discussions and debates out in the open, rather than potentially the place we got to, where we go back to that left behind argument or unheard voices.
One of the things that has been grinding on in relation to this for a number of years has, of course, been boundary review and changes to the amount of MPs in the House of Commons. How important do you think that is in relation to changing the democratic setup and making things a bit more equal across the board in terms of representation?
Yeah, that's an interesting one as well. And indeed, the boundaries, the Parliament Act, it has passed through in this session of Parliament, and indeed I led for the Liberal Democrats in both of those debates. I just think it's a false argument from the government that that all votes count equally if you have constituencies of equal size. And, you know, one of the key arguments around first past the post is this politics of place, you know, that you have and a member of parliament representing a defined area, but actually potentially trying to make each of those defined areas exactly the same size completely weakens that argument of politics of place. I mean, for me, my constituency borders the Glenrothes constituency, and the boundary line is the High Street of Leven, one of the main towns in the constituency. So one side of the town is town High Street is represented by me, and the other by another MP. And that doesn't suggest to me a degree of politics of place. And it's also a fallacy that you can't have a politics of place within a proportional representative system. The other thing I must say is obviously the boundary reviews are ongoing now, getting underway. But one of the other things that the government has committed to do in this parliament is to do away with the 15-year time limit for people living overseas to vote. Now, as a Liberal Democrat, I'm supportive of that. We believe that there should be overseas constituencies that would help you deal with the situation of Gibraltar, you know, which has been a forgotten part of the UK and in the Brexit negotiations. But what's potentially going to happen is you're going to have boundary reviews fixed on the end of March last year, which was the date that was agreed, and potentially you're going to have an unknown number of voters come into constituencies. So actually you're undermining that argument of equal constituencies at the same time. And the final thing to say is, by setting the parameters as narrowly as they have, there is a real risk that small changes in a constituency then have a butterfly effect on lots of other constituencies. So I think the reality is, for all that, obviously, all the Conservatives MPs supported the bill, when we actually see the outcomes of the boundary reviews, given the Conservatives' current majority, I suspect there's going to be quite a lot of unhappy Conservative MPs.
Now, just returning to one of the broader themes of the book, which is discussed in several essays, is the need for cooperation with other parties and social democracy in other countries. Now, looking at the United States for a moment, where Joe Biden has, of course, just been become president of the United States, do you think it's important to ensure that there is conversation in terms of social democracy and the spreading of social democratic ideas between parties in different countries, and encouraging, in a time of greater populism and nationalism, more cooperation between different social democratic parties?
Yes, in short, that's a short answer. I'm sure you would expect me to say that. And I suppose that's one of the key losses from a European Union perspective in terms of parties, UK parties having representation in the European Parliament and aligning with similar parties in other countries. I think the other bit, obviously, about social democracy is that leads you into that bit where you do need to I was a police officer for 12 years, so we talk about policing by consent, and I think governing by consent is really important as well. And I think what we have seen over the last decades, not just in the UK but elsewhere, clearly in the United States and the rise of some populist parties in some parts of Europe, is that one side feels that there isn't consent, and that there isn't that will to kind of move forward together. So I think that's really, really critical, and particularly when you look at some of the big challenges that are facing the world as a whole. Obviously, the pandemic is right at the forefront at the moment, but we know that what we need to do in terms of the climate emergency has not gone away, and those are going to require global approaches, but actually also hyper-local approaches as well. The reality is to really deal with the climate emergency, people are going to fundamentally have to change how they live their lives. And the reality is I suppose, in terms of our democracies currently, is there is a difficulty for politicians to look beyond what's required in order to ensure their next term in office. So we kind of lose that strategic direction. And so actually that's where the consensus comes in for me, because there should be broad agreement of this is the direction that we need to go in. So regardless of what party or parties are in power in more proportional systems, that the direction of travel is overall agreed.
Now, you mentioned obviously the climate emergency, and this is something that is again a reoccurring theme within the book. How easy do you think it will be to convince people that there is need for greater green energies, and that green businesses should be encouraged? Because, of course, there may be a reaction from some people who feel that, these green businesses or green industries might not provide the same quality of work that people had in previous industries. How do you think you make that argument to people?
Dare I say, I think the ecological changes that we're already seeing are in part doing that for us. Obviously, we've had very devastating floods in some parts of Wales and in England over this last week, and we can't, we can't not acknowledge that climate change is playing a part in that. I actually think a green recovery, and I'm somebody who did work in military settlements, supporting service leavers into jobs, so some recruitment. I think jobs within the green industry are actually some of the most exciting and innovative jobs that we're seeing currently. And if we look at, the decline of some of the core traditional sectors and increased automation in some of our service sectors, actually, that the green sector is where that creativity and innovation is going to come from and going to be offered to people.
Do you think, and I mean, obviously, we've touched a little bit on coronavirus, do you think that coronavirus and the impact that it has had on the economy is going to change the perspective that people have in terms of how money should be spent by the government, in a similar way that the Great Recession in the 1930s and to a certain extent the 2008 financial crisis made people reconsider how governments spend money and how they use money?
Yeah, I think, it's actually probably too early to say what those kind of longer term trends or impacts are going to be. We're still in full lockdown and vaccine rollout at an early stage. But I think the couple of things I can say is, whoever thought a Conservative government would spend in the way that we have seen this Conservative government spend over the last 12 months? And second of all, I don't think anybody has ever been saying at any point that we should be necessarily spending less. Clearly, there are some groups of MPs, such as the Coronavirus Research Group, who are looking for us to move out of lockdown as quickly as possible, but nobody is saying that the supports shouldn't be offered or shouldn't be in place. So I do think that driven by also people who, for the first time, have come into contact with our welfare system and never had an expectation they would do so, to find out that there's a lot of holes in it, I think there will be a degree of shift overall in terms of how we approach things. I think that will be the overall general consensus. I'm not necessarily convinced in the sort of medium term that's where the current government will be, but clearly they have, you know, the actions they have taken in the last 12 months have been quite unprecedented.
Now, throughout the book, one of the motifs that reoccurs is social democracy in contrast to populism and nationalism. Do you think that with the defeating of Donald Trump, coronavirus, and some of the inadequacies that we have seen from Brexit, that now is a time that we're going to begin to see a revival of social democracy and people supporting social democratic beliefs in Britain, Europe, and the wider world?
The answer to that, Will, is I very much hope so. But I also think that we probably have to be realistic. And so where we are just now, in terms of the current lockdown we're all experiencing in the UK, is a different place potentially where we were in the first lockdown. You know, January is not the best of months for people's mental health, or at the best of times. You know, it does feel like the month that has, you know, about 100 days in it, let alone 31. So, yeah, I do think that, so, and the reason why I'm saying that is just that there is an element of dissatisfaction, there's an element of increased politicisation or opportunism around what the government's doing or not doing. And clearly, when we look back 40 years and beyond that from a social democratic perspective, we didn't have the societal pressures that we have now. We didn't have the information channels, social media, et cetera, that we do now. I think, you know, there is no doubt that very extreme views have an outlet now in a way that they never had before. But I think the case that I and my colleagues, as we have in the book, would make is actually a social democratic approach is the best way to help the most people to live the, you know, to and to bring the liberal part of me in to, you know, achieve and gain the best life that is available to them.
We're coming towards the end of the podcast. It's been great to talk to you, Wendy. I've got one final question. We've discussed coronavirus throughout the podcast, and you mentioned the lockdown earlier. And because of that, obviously, people aren't able to do things that they would have normally done. But we're seeing the vaccine being rolled out across the country, and hopefully things will soon get back to some semblance of normality. When they do, what one thing that you haven't been able to do because of the lockdown and coronavirus are you most looking forward to being able to do again?
Well, I think at a very fundamental level, it's just hugging loved ones that don't live in the same house as me. My stepdaughter and our boyfriend just got engaged in October, and my stepson is and his girlfriend are due to have a baby imminently. And obviously, they didn't expect that they were going to, you know, when they said that they were expecting a lockdown baby, I'm sure we didn't anticipate that we would still be in lockdown. So I'm coming to terms with being a step granny shortly, but that's wonderful news. So there's that, and I think a lot of people would say that. My funny one that I would say is, you may or may not know this, but my sport is shinty, the Scottish sport of shinty. I was the first female director of the Cam and Act Association, and I last had a game of shinty on the 2nd of December. We had a sort of women's game that over 28s played the under 28s, and other than hang a shinty stick in my pink ribbon in the members in the members cloakroom in Parliament when I became chief whip, just as a bit of a joke, and I haven't actually picked up a shinty stick other than that, so I'm very much looking forward to the opportunity to get playing again.
Well, I hope that you will be able to play shinty again soon. Thank you again for coming on the podcast. If people want to find out more about the book and more about yourself, where should they go?
So follow the Social Democratic Group on social media channels, including Twitter. And for myself, you can follow me as Wendy Chambe LD on Twitter, Instagram and Facebook.
Excellent. Thank you once again for coming on the podcast.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the podcast. If you've enjoyed it, you can subscribe to us on iTunes, Spotify, Podbeam and Amazon Music. You can also follow us on Twitter, at Debated Podcast, like us on Facebook, Debated Podcast, and if you'd like to get in touch with us, whether about appearing on an episode of the podcast, or commenting on an episode that you've listened to, you can do so at thedebatedpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you for listening. I hope you listen to the next one.